Take your Bibles, if you would, open them up to the book of Judges, Judges chapter 3. I thought we might get to the first judge tonight, but I don't think we're going to make it, so that'll have to wait to our next time that we study this. But we are starting a chapter where we will find the first judge when we get down to verse 9 and beyond. And again, but that'll be next time. But let me just give you a refresher of sort of where we are. Joshua had led the people across the Jordan River into the Promised Land. God had told the people, I'm not going to give it to you all at once. I'll give you, and you will be able to take, with my help, the portion of land that you need now. And God used Joshua to lead the people to accomplish that. And then God told them, when you grow in number, when you're able to handle more, I will give you more. But not until then. And I was thinking the last couple of days, you know, God still works that same way today. He knows what we can handle, both good and bad. You know, we read and we study 1 Corinthians 10:13, that verse in the Bible that many of us have run to at different times and claim the promise that's in it, where the Bible says, there hath no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that ye are able, but will with the temptation also make a way to escape, that ye may be able to bear it. And we use that verse and we apply it to temptations that may come into our life, temptations to sin, temptations to do wrong. And we can claim the promise in that book that God will never allow us to be tempted in a way that we can't handle, in a way that he doesn't give us a way to escape. That's a joy and a comfort to me, knowing that God knows my limits and will not allow me to be tempted with something I can handle. Same way when heartaches come into our life, he knows our load limit. He knows how much we can handle, how much we can bear. And we can claim the promise that he'll never let bad things, so to speak, and I'll put them in quotes, bad things, because some of the bad things that God sends into our life are really good things, but he'll never let those things mount up and be more than we can handle. But stop and think about it. That verse also applies to good things, to blessings. God knows how many blessings we can handle, and sometimes too much good is worse than the baddest of the bad. Now, again, we don't stop and think about that, but sometimes too much good is worse than the worst of the bad that can come into our life. And so God, just like he controls the temptations, just like he controls the heartaches and knows our limit, he also knows our limit for how much good we can handle and will never give us more good than we can handle. And I hate to break anybody's bubble, but that's probably why nobody in this room tonight will win the $550 million in the lotto. Some of you look disappointed. But God probably knows that none of us can handle that, and so we won't win. He did it for Israel. He said, now look, I'm not going to give you all the land. You're not big enough. If I gave it all to you, if I drove out everybody, then the wild animals and the weeds and the thistles will grow. And you're just not big enough to handle it. So again, I'll give you what you need now. And he did that under Joshua's leadership. And when you grow, I will give you more. Now, we are at the point where they have grown. They need more. God was ready to give them more, but there was a problem. And we read about it as we finished up chapter 2. A few weeks ago, and let me just start in chapter 2 tonight. If you have your Bibles open, chapter 2, verse 20. And the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel, and he said, because that this people hath transgressed my covenant, which I commanded their fathers, and have not hearkened unto my voice, I also will not henceforth drive out any from before them of the nations which Joshua left when he died, that through them I may prove Israel, whether they will keep the way of the Lord to walk therein, as their fathers did keep it, or not. Therefore the Lord left those nations without driving them out hastily, neither delivered he them into the hand of Joshua. So he said, now look, you're at the point that I knew you were going to get to. You've grown. You've grown in number. You need more land. I was going to give it to you, but I'm not, because you've disobeyed. You've broken the covenants, the agreements that I made with your fathers through Moses. And not only have you broken the covenant, you have ignored my rebukes. You have ignored the people that I've sent into your midst to rebuke you for breaking those covenant. I would have driven out more. I mean, you're at the point where you need it. But I won't drive them out now. I will leave those people there to prove you, to see if you will walk in my ways or not, to see if you will obey my commandments, to see if you will get back to keeping the covenants. And then as we go into chapter 3, in the first couple of verses, God adds another reason for leaving the people there, the Canaanites there, the Philistines there. So look at chapter 3, verses 1 and 2. Now these are the nations which the Lord left to prove Israel by them, even as many of Israel as had not known all the wars of Canaan, only that the generations of the children of Israel might know to teach them war, at the least some as before knew nothing thereof. So here's what God's saying. Not only am I going to leave these peoples here, I was going to drive them out, drive out more of them, but I'm going to leave them because I want to prove you. I want to know if you're going to follow my covenants. I want to know if you're going to follow my commandments. But there's another reason. He says there's some people here that came on the scene right as Joshua was finishing up the campaign to take the land. They knew some of the wars that Joshua fought. Not all of them, because they weren't born, but they knew some of them. And then God goes on to say, and there are some among you that don't know anything about the wars of Joshua, because you were born after they were over. And so I'm going to leave these people here so that those that didn't experience all of them and those that didn't experience any of them can learn about war, can learn what it is to have to fight for the land and fight for what you have. Again, there were some there that weren't aware of it because, again, they were born after the fight was over. And God says, he says, I'm going to leave these people here so that you will have to learn how to fight. God says, if all you have is the milk and honey of the land of Canaan, you're going to grow weak. You're going to grow unappreciative. The people that have to fight and did fight for the land are the ones that appreciate it, are the ones that know that it was God that gave it to them. If those that never have to fight, that never had to fight, that were now just enjoying the milk and honey of the land of Canaan, they began to take it for granted because they never paid the price. They never paid, knew the cost. And they never knew how good God was in giving them the land because they never marched around the city of Jericho. They never went up against Ai. They never went into the other campaigns that Joshua led them in. And so God says, so to help you appreciate what you have and remember the God that gave it to you, I'm going to leave this people so that you will learn how to fight. You will learn about war. And then God says, and by the way, the land is rich and it's desirable. And you are surrounded by enemies that one day or another will attack. And you need to be ready because you've learned about war. Those of you that have never experienced it, those of you that experienced a little bit of it, but not all of it, you need to learn how to fight because enemies from the outside are going to attack. And you need to be ready to defend against those attacks. And the art of war is best learned by experience. I mean, we can send people to West Point and to the Naval Academy, and we can teach them all about war. But the art of war is best learned when people have to fight. And so God says, I'm going to leave this people, and they're going to rise up, and you're going to have to fight them so that you can be experienced when the big attacks come. Now, we know Israel pictures the church. And the lessons for Israel are that God was teaching them are also lessons for us. You know, there's some people that come to church and they expect there never to be a problem. They expect never to be a difficulty. They expect everybody to just love one another and get along all the time. But there's some problems with those expectations because a church is made up of human beings. And human beings are going to disagree. And when human beings disagree, there'll sometimes arise problems and difficulties. And I've known some people that have prayed, Lord, protect us and let none of those problems and none of those difficulties come into our church. And I'll just tell you tonight, I don't believe that God answers a prayer like that. Because God knows that anything that's worthwhile doesn't get stronger at ease. Anything that's worthwhile doesn't get stronger at ease. The things that get stronger are those that have to fight against resistance and work to overcome that resistance. Okay? So, for example, it's true as you're trying to build your muscles. You do not build muscles at ease. I mean, you just don't sit down in a chair and turn on your favorite TV show and watch TV and your muscles get stronger. Sorry, it doesn't work that way. You get stronger by lifting weights. And you don't get stronger, I mean, let's say you take a 5-pound weight and you just start lifting a 5-pound weight. Pretty soon, you'll have to increase the resistance or your strength building will quit. I mean, you'll get to the point where you can easily lift 5 pounds, 25 pounds. You put the number in there that you're more comfortable with. But in order to get stronger, you have to keep increasing the resistance. You have to keep increasing the weight. Same thing is true in marriage. Strong marriages are not the marriages that have no problems. A strong marriage is not built on a bed of ease, where there is no problems. Strong marriages are those that have figured out how to work through the problems. And the same thing is true about a church. A strong church is not a church that never has any problems. Because a church that has no problems pretty soon will grow complacent and begin to take for granted what we have. And begin to think that it will always be this way. A strong church, again, is not a church that doesn't have any problems. A strong church is a church that has problems and with Christian love and a dependence on God, figures out how to handle them. Figures out how to use the problem to get stronger, grow closer to not only the Lord, but to each other, and stronger working through the problems. Oh, and by the way, there are forces outside the church, just like there were forces outside of Israel, that are ready to attack. Satan will. Our culture will. I mean, there are groups that are pushing their own agendas that don't want churches preaching from the Bible. They want us to quit calling sin, sin. And, you know, they get behind the banner of brotherly love. Let's all get along. Let's not offend anybody. And they'll attack. And they'll begin to pass laws that say, oh, no, you're committing a hate crime when you call sin, sin. So God said to his people, hey, you got to learn how to fight. You got to learn how to get stronger. I'm going to leave these people here. And if you look at the nation of Israel, he's never stopped doing that. I mean, all you have to do is read the newspaper from the past couple of weeks and know that God's people need to know how to defend themselves, and down through the ages, he has given them time after time after time where they had to learn how to fight, and they still do. So, who did he leave? Well, who did God leave? Look at verse 3. Namely, five lords of the Philistines and all the Canaanites and the Sidonians and the Hivites that dwell in Mount Lebanon from Mount Baal Hermon until the entering in of Hamath. So the five lords of the Philistines, Ashdod, Gaza, Ashkelon, Gath, and Ekron. Now, if you remember from our study of the first chapter of Judges, when Judah and Simon went to fight, they fought against the Philistines and took a large part of three of their cities. By the time we get to chapter 3, those cities had been rebuilt. They'd been retaken by the Philistines. They had reconsolidated their strength. And God was going to use the Philistines to prove his people, to teach them how to fight, all the way through the book of Judges, and we will see it especially when we get to Samson. The Philistines were there, and the Philistines really weren't defeated again completely until David came on the scene. I mean, they were around. And then there were the Canaanites and the Sidonians. They lived on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea, and then the Hivites that lived in Mount Lebanon. And then look at verse 5. Skip verse 4 just for a minute. Look down at verse 5. And the children of Israel dwelt among the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, and Perizzites, and the Hivites, and Jebusites. So there were not only those that were mentioned in verse 3, but there were other Canaanites that were scattered throughout the land. Maybe not a big grouping of any of them, but scattered throughout the land, and the Israelites, and notice what it says, and the children of Israel dwelt among them. To me, that's a little backwards, because this was the Israelites' land. God had given it to them. I mean, he had promised it to them, and you read verse 5, and it's like the children of Israel dwelt among them, like they were there by their permission, that they were there because the Canaanites and the others said, okay. And I'll just point out to you, I don't believe that was the way God intended his people to live. They were not to be living among the Canaanites at all. Again, this was their land. They were promised it by God, and they were living in a way that God did not intend for them to live because they didn't fully claim the promises that God had made them. He said, hey, this land is yours. I prepared it for you. You're going to live in cities you didn't build and drink from wells you didn't dig and eat from orchards and vineyards you didn't plant. And my eye's going to be on you, and this is your land. And yet they were living as tenants. They were living there among the people in a way that God did not intend for them to live because they didn't fully claim his promises. And before we criticize them too much, how many Christians today are doing the same thing? We're living our Christian life, and for the most part, it's good, but we get entangled with the things of the world, and we never fully claim the promises that God has made for us. And in some cases, we're living a life that God never intended us to live. He said, hey, I've come not only to give you life, but life more abundantly. And sometimes we miss the abundantly. We have the life, but we miss the abundantly because we never fully claim the promises that God has made. Now go back to verse 4. And they were to prove Israel by them, to know whether they would hearken unto the commandments of the Lord, which he commanded their fathers by the hand of Moses." He said again, "Look, I'm leaving them here to prove you. I just want to, God said, I want to know one simple thing. I want to know one simple thing. Are you going to be obedient? That's it. Are you going to be? I gave my covenant, my laws, my commandments, however, whatever you want to call them. I gave them to your fathers by Moses, by the hand of Moses. You know them. You know them." And God said, it's simple. It's not rocket science. I just want your obedience. I just want you to trust me enough to obey. So how'd they do? Look at verses 6 and 7. "And they took their daughters to be their wives and gave their daughters to their sons and served their gods. And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and forgot the Lord their God and served Balaam and the groves." How'd they do? They failed. They failed. They took the daughters of the land of Canaan to be wives for their sons. They gave their daughters to the sons of Canaan to be their wives. They intermarried. And if you've read much of the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, especially when you get into Exodus and Numbers and Deuteronomy, the thing that God warned his people over and over and over and over again, the thing he warned them about more than anything else when it came to the people of the land of Canaan, he says, do not intermarry with them because they'll draw you away from me. You'll begin to worship their gods. And that's exactly what happened. And notice what it says in verse 7. I could preach a whole sermon on that. This. "The children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and forgot the Lord their God." The only way they could start worshiping Baal is to forget the kind of God that they had. Because if they would have remembered the kind of God that they had, in no way would they have begun to worship Baal. The psalmist says, oh yeah, here's the God of the heathen. They have ears, but they can't hear. They have eyes, but they can't see. They have hands, but they can't handle. They have feet, but they can't go anywhere. And here's our God, the God that doeth wonders, the God that nothing is impossible for. And the only way you can start worshiping something like this is forget about this. Because if you remember the kind of God that you have, there's no way you're going to turn your back on that God and worship Baal. Now, it says Baal and the groves. The worship of Baal took place around clusters of trees because the trees made a natural temple. And so they worshiped there. I just tell you, as we close tonight, serving God hasn't changed. It's still simple. It's still not rocket science. It's trust and obey, for there's no other way to be happy in Jesus but to trust and obey. Obedience is the very best way to show that you believe. Doing exactly what the Lord commands, doing it happily. Action is the key. Do it immediately. Joy you will receive. Obedience is the very best way to show that you believe. God says it's simple. I just want to know that you trust me enough to obey me. And I'm going to leave these people here to prove you. And I wonder, how many things has God had to leave in our life to prove us? You ever stop and think about that? I mean, these were his people. He loved them. I don't think he wanted to do what he had to do, but he had to do it. He had to do it. And I dare say there are probably things in each of our lives that God doesn't want to leave there. But he's had to leave there to find out
Are we going to trust him? Are we going to be obedient? Are we going to do what he says? Glad you're here tonight. Let's stand and we'll have a word of prayer. Be dismissed.